Now that the U.S. has left Afghanistan, is the war on terror over? Well, 2 decades into it, our next guest argues no. We remain in a post-9/11 forever war because the policies and narratives after the attack shaped the public conversation and eventually led to the rise of one Donald J. Trump. That is according to investigative journalist Spencer Ackerman. His new book is Reign of Terror, How the 9/11 Era Destabilized America and Produced Trump. And Spencer, let's go straight to the title here. What did 9/11 activate in the culture and in the machinery of government that you say connects to the rise of Donald Trump?
From the start, the war on terror functioned as a doorway to the most nativist, the most violent, and the most racist aspects of American history, gave them license to pursue power in the atmosphere of righteous patriotic violence, and the mechanisms of the government that are meant to safeguard our freedom, our rights, and our security transformed tremendously so as to provide for extensive suspicionless surveillance, the creation of a large law enforcement informant network in places of worship, such as mosques, the transformation of immigration from a means of producing more Americans into a security context that threatened those that were already here, and so on, until ultimately a series of authoritarian possibilities were provided by the war on terror, and its culture justified their use.
And as you kind of describe in your book, it's permanent war. Now, as far as Donald Trump, are you arguing that he understood this nativist context in this September 12 reality that America's in? Of course, we all remember years ago he made this birther claim, fact-free, that Barack Obama was a Muslim born in Kenya.
He really understood the subtext of the war on terror better than most politicians, or at least he was the one who wanted to celebrate and exploit that subtext while more mainstream politicians wanted to kind of ignore it and pretend that it wasn't there. In addition to birtherism, which we should have to remember, gets its force by the fact that it's calling Barack Obama a secret foreign Muslim at a time when the culture of the war on terror held such people as threats to American security. He was a leading figure stoking fear amongst New Yorkers against a Muslim cultural center in downtown Manhattan that he and others referred to as the Ground Zero Mosque. And in general, while simultaneously supporting and claiming later that he never supported the overseas wars, he consistently referred to how they needed to be fought with ever more brutality.
Okay, now, you, of course, were a part of the Guardian reporting team that won the Pulitzer for your reporting on Edward Snowden's revelations about the National Security Agency. I want to ask you about the role of the security state as, I guess, kind of a spine of this story. I mean, how was this hyper-surveillance justified and how has it endured these decades?
Well, certainly it was justified when it became public, which was years after it began, on the idea that it was necessary to stop terrorist attacks. George W. Bush called it, after the fact, the Terrorist Surveillance Program, a name that propagandistically suggests that only terrorists were under surveillance when no such thing happened. Instead, there was NSA capability unleashed that allowed it to hoover up without discrimination a tremendous amount of Americans' communications data under the name of this emergency. And then over time, the more of it that got exposed, ultimately more of it was normalized in some degree by law in 2008. But more generally, the surveillance achieved a kind of escape velocity where the NSA, as it currently stands through a program called PRISM that we in the Washington Post exposed thanks to Edward Snowden, the surveillance piggybacks on the servers of major social media and internet data giants, which basically mediate through everything that you and I use on a daily basis, the kind of cost of doing business in the 21st century economy. So what starts after 9/11 as a frankly illegal, and they knew it, program, no matter how much they wanted to lawyer it away, now is embedded in the architecture of the 21st century economy.
And I want to ask you about, I guess, your thoughts on the different ways there have been costs of this war on terror. I gather you might consider these American digital freedoms and liberties part of the cost on this. But more broadly, do you think about the overt and the hidden costs to Americans of this forever war period?
So much of what we've experienced after 9/11 has been the steady erosion of democratic safeguards that are meant to keep the freedoms that Americans think they possess in perpetuity. These have just sustained sledgehammer blow after sledgehammer blow, usually from an acquiescent judicial system, usually from a political and journalistic infrastructure that typically, more typically than not, goes along with the prerogatives of the war on terror far more than they challenge it. And as a result, you get a very brittle democracy, deeply divided, lying in wait for an authoritarian figure like Trump, and as the war on terror progresses, like future Trumps, who will take the opportunities presented by both the culture and the institutional structure of the war on terror, what's already been normalized as well as what remains on the horizon, and do something with it. And they may turn out to be far more competent than Donald Trump was.
Can I come back to this, I guess, the cultural framework as part of this? You describe Donald Trump and others understanding this nativist framing here. But I think our listeners might be surprised that you're right about the role of others on the left and in the center of the political conversation. How do you think about President Obama's role in continuing this framing?
When the war on terror was established shortly after 9/11, it occurred with overwhelming support and extremely minimal criticism from the Democratic Party. That persisted for a tremendous amount of time and resulted
in
the leadership
for the Patriot Act and so many other these authorizations of war.
The Iraq War, the authorization to use military force that has become a wellspring for all of this. Obama sought to jettison the Iraq War and jettison torture by the CIA and the military. Outside of that, he was pretty flexible and ended up ratifying much, much more of the war on terror than he ended up jettisoning, becoming synonymous with drone strikes, returning to war in Iraq and adding Syria onto that list of active battlefields.
And finally, let me ask you then where you think this framework of emergency goes from here. Does this go on, or is there a way for some of these forces that are aligned to eventually come to an end?
Well, the record over the past 20 years shows that elite politics will only perpetuate the war on terror. If the war on terror is to be stopped, it's got to come from ordinary American citizens organizing together and demanding a binary choice out of their candidates for political office. Either those candidates can maintain the war on terror or they can enjoy political power, but not both. The only thing that has restrained the war on terror substantively has been politicians feeling the pressure of popular anger and frustration over the wars. Biden, even while withdrawing from Afghanistan, talks about an enduring counterterrorism capability that spans the world and is unconstrained by any time limitation. That's been a pattern throughout the war on terror. Think about Obama seeking to withdraw from Iraq while escalating in Afghanistan. Typically, rescission on one or other war on terror battlefield is accompanied by escalation elsewhere, or even maintenance of the same enterprise from, as the Pentagon likes to say, over the horizon.
The book is Reign of Terror, How the 9/11 Era Destabilized America and Produced Trump. The author is Spencer Ackerman, and provocative read. Spencer, thanks very much.
Thank you very much for having me.